Hey everybody, we're back with Bitches on Comics. It's me, Sarah Century, and my host.
Hi, I'm Essie Fleenor. Sarah's my host, and I'm Sarah's host, and that's how we keep the power. It's our checks and balances. You may never have heard of those since we don't have a functioning government, but we have checks and balances here at Bitches on Comics. Ooh, yeah. Too topical?
That's hilarious. Well. I was just cracking up because I was like, how long is it going to take us to go down the well? And it took us no time. Zero seconds.
I was like, I see an open door. I'm just busting my head through. We're really excited and weird today because we have the incredible Aiden Thomas joining us. Aiden Thomas is the New York Times bestselling author of Cemetery Boys. Aiden, thank you for being here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm so excited. Like, this is going to be fun. This is going to be a good time.
Yeah.
It's also still so weird to hear people be like, oh, New York Times bestselling author, Aiden Thomas. Right. I'm like, oh, me? Weird.
Yeah, totally. That is definitely one of my questions. How weird is your life now? But before we get into those fun questions, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's the Rosetta Stone of understanding Aiden Thomas?
Oh my gosh. About me. So I'm a trans Latinx non-binary author. I pretty much strictly write young adults because I don't think I'm enough of an adult to write adult books. Maybe one day, but who knows? Let's see. I live in Portland, but I was born and raised in Oakland, California. So that's kind of still where my heart is. And I'm like a plant dad. That's the new title that I've gotten over quarantine. I like obsessively collect plants now, and I think I've only killed one at this point. And honestly, I think that's a pretty good record.
That's so incredible.
That's like what I'm into right now.
I was so excited just to be like, that's a great record because I too am currently being a plant dad. I don't know if it is because of quarantine, but it certainly is a recent development. Sadly, have had, I think, about 3 go, but.
My life needs meaning at this point. So I'm like, plants. The plants need me to be a functional human. So I will do it for my plants.
I'm just going to become poison ivy. And that's my plan.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I'm definitely Harley. I'm like, should I buy an entire apartment just for cats and dogs?
Yes.
Leaning towards yes. Yeah, if it wasn't for my little dog, I would not be okay in quarantine. I am so grateful. He'll just like, even today, he could tell I was stressed. My partner came in like right before he started recording and was like, oh, I'm just coming to give you a kiss on the forehead. And I was like, get out! I am too stressed out! And then my dog came in and was like, yo, bitch, you need to fucking chill. And I was like, you're right.
And you're like,
you are right.
Yeah, I have a dog and a cat. And yeah, they're definitely the ones getting me through it. The nice thing about dogs is that like, if you're like feeling bummed or stressed out, you can just like make excited noises at them. And then suddenly they're stoked out of their minds. And then you're like, yeah, this is cool. It's like a nice little ego boost.
That's so true. I didn't even realize I was doing that to make myself feel better. And now I do. So in addition to being a New York Times bestselling author, you are also now my therapist. So congratulations. That should work out for all of us.
Oh, God.
I just appoint random people my therapist. It's my new thing. Great. Amazing. So stoked to have you here. So stoked to talk about your writing process and your incredible works. And you're such a lovely person. It's so fun to follow you on Twitter. What is your handle if people want to follow you?
Okay. So this question always makes me laugh. Because of the pandemic and everything, I've only ever been to like one convention to like talk about me and my books and stuff like that. And it was before I was published. So I don't even know if it counts. But at one point at like the end, everyone was like, so where can we find y'all on the internet? Like, what are your handles? And then like, they were just like going down the list and everyone was like, my first name and my last name, or like my first initial and my last name. And then it got to me and I was like, my name's Aiden Thomas and my handle is Aiden Schmaden. Like, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter. And everyone started laughing and I'm like, well, nobody told me like when I was getting into this that I should like sound professional or whatever. My handle is Aiden Schmaden, and that's on Twitter and Instagram.
That's perfect. I remember once hearing Francesca Lee talk about that, and she was like, I made my handle like Cheska Lee, and now I have to include my middle name in everything I do for the rest of my life, because otherwise people won't know who I am. And I was like, that's a good point. That's like the day I went and changed my handle from some random shit to like my name.
Yeah.
Like, learn from others' mistakes. So Cemetery Boys is this incredible YA novel about a young gay trans boy named Yadriel and his ghost boyfriend named Julian. And it's tight in many ways in terms of plotting and characterization, but it's also expansive. I mean, not just in the sense of painting this picture of many different Latinx cultures living in community together, but also in sort of representing what magic and brujería in particular can mean beyond the bounds of sort of like cishet society. I'm just curious, you know, I've read a little bit about how you came up with the idea, and I believe Tumblr played a role, but I was curious if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I was on my Tumblr, which I think is also Aiden Schmain, but I'm trying to remember, but I'm not sure. And I follow like a bunch of writing prompt blogs. Like, what I love so much about Tumblr is that it really helps spark a lot of kind of creativity and story ideas for me. So following writing prompt blogs is like a big thing that I do. And it was like in the middle of the night, and I was just kind of scrolling through my dash, and the prompt that I came upon, it was super small. It was just a sentence. And it was, what would you do if you summoned a ghost and then you couldn't get rid of it? And I was looking at all the like reblogs and replies and people being like, oh, this is really like scary ghost story, and like, oh, it's so spooky and stuff like that. But like, meanwhile, I read that and I was like, yeah, what if I summoned a ghost and I couldn't get rid of him? And what if he was really cute? And so that was like what sparked the basic idea for the story.
What if he was really cute is the part that like so perfect.
Yeah. And then like, you know, forced proximity trope is like built right into it, right? I knew I wanted my MC to be trans, gay, and Latinx. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do that and we're talking about a ghost, then that just immediately aligns up with my favorite holiday, which is Dia de Muertos. So kind of having those two basic ideas come together, and then just the plot just exploded from there. And it was really, really fun.
That's amazing. So you had these like different sources of inspiration. And sometimes when I'm describing really cool, really weird fiction, I describe it like a stew. Like you kind of just kept throwing things in and you knew when to stop. How did you know when to stop? Was there anything you had to go remove?
I didn't know when to stop. It was really funny because I was like writing this book, and when I sent, I think, the very first draft to my editor, and I was like, and here's all these other ideas that I want to incorporate, and I want to talk about this, and I want to talk about racism, and I want to talk about border and deportation and homeless kids. And my poor editor was like, Aiden, I don't know if we have enough room to unpack all of that. He was like, you know, we got to keep it around like, you know, 95,000 words. And so I kept coming up with all these ideas and like scenes and wanting to throw them like into the story because they were like important to me. And it was hard. My editor had to help me be like, okay, look at it and really focus on what's really important to the story and to you that you really want to talk about. Otherwise, it would have ended up being like 600 pages long. and that would have been a bit much. It's hard to pitch a 600-page book.
It certainly is. It's, well, maybe not so much right now for you, though. Like, I'm like, where's your epic fantasy? I'm ready. I will pick it up whenever you get it out there. Not that I'm giving you an assignment. Do whatever the hell you want, obviously. I'll read whatever. But yeah, you know, I think what's so cool is the complexity. You bring so many issues to the table, but they're brought so organically. When you were talking about homelessness, I thought about Flaca. And, you know, she's this side character who's a trans woman and is homeless. And her relationship with Julian is, to me, so much of what makes him such a protector. You know, like he really does see himself as like his job in the world is to like take care of people. And I think that's like part of why it's so scary for him when he realizes he's dead. When I think about Flaca in particular, and I'm thinking about the scene where they go down to underneath the highway where Flaca and Co. are hanging out in tents and, you know, worried about Julian. And I just keep thinking about the way that another queer trans person sees her and how that influences the way the narrative, you as a queer trans person, Yadriel as a queer trans person, communicating about who she is and how she is present. And even as she's described as like small, and I don't think you use the term waifish, but that's the term that comes to mind. You know, she still has so much power. I'd love to hear you talk about how you wrote about characters who are disenfranchised, purposely marginalized, and maligned in our society, but you gave them so much power. There's no coming in and being like, oh, look at the poor homeless kids. Mm. As much as, you know, you do feel like, oh my God, this is a wrong. There's no pitying. And how did you find that balance of showing like the real pain and lived experiences of these challenges while giving them a source of power that though, you know, Yadriel has magic, they don't all have magic. How did you balance that?
Honestly, it was taking like real life examples and like people that I knew, people that I connected with. The first time I ever like saw another trans person, it was a trans girl. And I was so in awe and kind of amazed by her and being like, how is she not terrified every day of her life? And I think what's really important and why Laka was important for me to have in this book and be that character that Yads first gets to see is that that power doesn't have anything to do with physicality, with how you look or how you act or anything like that, but it's really the bravery behind it. And for me, that was the most important thing about writing Cemetery Boys, is to really highlight that bravery within our communities and how important it can be, not only to the individual, but to other folks, other closeted folks or folks who are still trying to figure out like their own situation, to literally just see someone in front of you that is like you is life-changing. And it's also very brave to do for that person. You know, it's hard being a non-passing trans person in the world. It's terrifying and it's dangerous, but it's also doing such important things to other kids who are afraid to be themselves or who think that they're only going to be met with a life of suffering and fear if they decide to, you know, come out or share with others what their identity is. And so when I was writing Cemetery Boys, that was kind of the whole basis for this story, is that I wanted to have that representation. I wanted to show what bravery looks like and welcoming people into the space and showing them characters that are like themselves, but that are very powerful and that are doing these really big and important things, even if it's on like a smaller scale, even if it's just Flocka being who she is on the page, or something really big, like, yeah, it's doing all of, you know, not no spoilers, but being a very powerful brujo and accomplishing other tasks that we won't talk about because I don't want to spoil. But yeah, so for me, it was important to show those characters and show them being powerful and being brave, but most importantly, being loved for exactly who they were.
I think that's one of the things that makes it so striking is, you know, the moment in the kitchen where Yads is talking to his grandma and she misgenders him and I believe uses his dead name. And what I love is up to that point, we've seen Yads really striving for acceptance, really trying to prove he has a right to be there. It's a subtle shift, but he's different from that moment forward in the book. He's like, I don't deserve this and I don't have to be misgendered. What I see so much and what I think makes their love so beautiful between Yads and Julian is how Julian comes in and is like, oh, that's the tip of the iceberg, baby. Like, you really think there's never been non-binary or trans brujos? You really think that? You like believe these people? And, you know, Yads has this moment of like, I kind of picture him like in the Twilight Zone, sort of like falling backwards through stars where he's just like, what the fuck? That's a great point. And what I see there is the way that when we're isolated, we can know truths in our gut. And we might doubt them, but we can know them. But when we come together, we know them from a place of power and of owning it. From then forward, Yads really is like, yeah, no, I have a right to be here. You've been silencing part of us, and that's not right. But I love that like he comes to his trans power through his relationship with a cis gay ghost. Like, that is so cool. It's so fun. And I'm wondering, you know, did you always imagine them as sort of like complementary to each other? And what do you think Yads does for Julian in sort of Julian's understanding of his identity?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And for Julian, when I was like thinking of like, who is this counterpart going to be for Yads going through this journey specifically? And there was a couple of things that I wanted to do with Julian. And the first one being that I wanted to subvert people's assumptions of what a forward-thinking person looks like. So you have Julian. And like, if you saw him like running the block with his friends, you wouldn't look at him and be like, ah, now there's like an upstanding member of the like queer community who understands the nuance of like gender diversity and stuff like that. So I wanted to subvert that to start with. I also wanted to give Yads a love interest who he doesn't have to teach how to love him. Julian, as soon as he is told that Yads is a boy, he takes a second to process that and kind of refigure his thought process and then acts accordingly for like the rest of the book. And to kind of have this love interest where you don't have to be like, I'm trans and this is what that means to me. And like, this is how, you know, in order to be with a trans person, you need to understand all these things. He already knew, he already understood. And that's because of Laka and because of his other friends. And yeah, I just really wanted the romance between them to be easy. I didn't want it to be this fraught thing. I had no interest in Julian having a crisis over his sexuality because he's gay and Yads is a boy. So there's not an issue. Like, it's just how it is. And so kind of having that character for Yads to kind of see that like, oh, this can be easy. Like my circumstances and even myself at some point, I'm making this difficult or my family is making this difficult for me, but it doesn't have to be difficult. And so I think that that was like the really important part for me when I was kind of building their relationship and deciding what that dynamic was going to look like.
I read in an interview where you were talking about vulnerability being the hardest part of writing. And I was just wondering, in Cemetery Boys, what was one of the more vulnerable moments that you had while you were writing?
You know, like we just talked about a second ago, that moment between Yads and Letha. So when his grandmother misgenders him and uses his dead name, and his response to that. That was a very vulnerable moment for me because I think a really common thing, especially in my family, is that my family is very accepting and loving. And I've never had issues with my immediate family around my gender or my sexuality, but there's still these slip-ups. And it can be really difficult because when you're a trans person and you're trying to encourage good behavior, like my own mom, she'll misgender me sometimes and she'll dead name me sometimes. And it can be really hard to want to correct the behavior or be like, please, like, stop doing that. Because we know that they're trying and we know that they care and they don't really see how their words like impact us internally. So when I was writing that scene, what I really wanted to do was like, yes, have this be a very valid experience on the page for trans readers that they can relate to. But I also wanted it to be a teachable moment for allies to show them that when you do make these slip ups and stuff like that, we might hold ourselves back from responding because we don't want to suddenly like hurt someone's feelings and then be like, okay, well, I'm not even going to try if you're going to get mad at me or whatever. So it's a difficult thing to kind of grapple with to be like, oh, like you're hurting me right now, but also I want to like encourage the good behavior and not like have you suddenly like shut off from me. So that was a really kind of vulnerable and a very real experience that I have myself with not just family, but a lot of people.
Yeah, I was going to say, I loved it. I loved that Yads didn't just absorb it. You know, I think a lot of people really liked Janet from The Good Place, and I get why, but like, I'm not gonna fucking smile and giggle while I tell you I'm not a girl, because I'm actually pretty pissed off that you're doing this.
Yeah.
What else do you want? I could put my pronouns on my forehead, but you're misgendering me without looking at me, so I don't know what to tell you, friends.
Yeah.
So what I really loved in the work is how much honor there was for rage. Like, Yads is allowed to be angry. Julian's allowed to be angry, and not just allowed to be, but that can be a source of strength and inspiration for them. And I'm curious if that comes from that same vulnerable place or, you know, your own experiences around being angry or frustrated, or if you're just, you really get the rage, and I just want you to talk about it.
Yeah, I think, like, absolutely, that's definitely part of it. And I think what's kind of funny is that I feel like trans folks, especially trans mask folks, kind of have this reputation of being like really angry all the time and like having like a hairpin trigger or whatever. And I think what people don't realize is that it's because of the constant battle to be ourselves and coming up against people dead naming and misgendering. So these tiny microaggressions, I don't think people understand how those build up over time and time again. So when like a trans person lashes out at you for dead naming or for misgendering them, it's not because you accidentally called them a she in this one moment. It's because they've accidentally been called she for the last 2 years of their lives on a daily basis. So it's not just that one incident. It's a buildup of incidences slowly like wears away at folks. So it's not just this anger that's coming out of nowhere. It's a compilation and a buildup of trauma and anger. And so that response is incredibly valid. So it's not about you. It's about what that person has been going through. And I also think that there's a really teachable moment. Like it's humiliating, of course. I understand that, to kind of be called out, especially in an aggressive way. But also to be called out really aggressively usually means that you're not going to do that again, because you don't want to go through that feeling or that embarrassment. So I understand how it can be really terrible to be on the receiving end of it, but I bet money you're not going to slip up as easily next time.
Right. I've definitely had these situations where I just think that people are a lot more forgiving even than, because I mean, this whole book, the whole point of that scene is you talk about it as a little bit of a teachable moment, a little bit of a venting moment, but like also a teachable moment. And I think that that's usually how it is. Like, I think that people really do extend the hand a lot more than like lash out or something like that. Like, I don't think that that happens very often, because to me, it's always just like, did they really lash out at you? You know,
yeah. Like,
that's kind of how I usually feel about it. But yeah, to me, I thought that the moment really was good because it is so forgiving, you know, it's like, there's so much forgiveness behind it, I feel like. And also, it's not even about that, right? Like, it's about somebody making clear boundaries and defining who they are.
Totally. Yeah.
That's a great point, Sarah. I like that. Because that's what I was thinking, too. So often, people interpret as aggression as just, like, a healthy boundary. It's like, yeah. No, you can't cross this line. I don't care. You know, like, people don't know what to do with that shit. We are not raised to be like, I respect your boundaries. Doesn't happen enough. So yeah, okay, you're like the first trans author on the New York Times bestseller for a trans book. How weird is that to hear? And is your life weird now? And are you still getting used to being successful? Like, talk to us about what's happened to you since Cemetery Boys came out?
Yeah, just to clarify, it's actually a fiction book, because we've actually had some really wonderful nonfiction pieces written by some really incredible trans writers on the New York Times bestseller list, which is
incredible.
I knew
I was forgetting something, so thank you so much.
It's very weird. Not a lot has changed, other than I have way too many followers on Twitter. because we're in a pandemic, like, I've spent my entire writing career as an author in a pandemic. I haven't been able to go to any events in person. I haven't been able to meet readers, which is kind of the most heartbreaking thing about it for me personally. Like, my focus has always and will always be on readers and like connecting with readers. So kind of not having that has been really difficult. And yeah, it's weird, because like this whole experience exists on my laptop and on my phone. Like, in real life, like, nothing has changed. It's just kind of, you know, this hypothetical on the internet ether thing of being like, oh, you're a New York Times bestselling author. But right now that doesn't really mean anything, because we're all stuck at home. So that's been kind of weird. And I'm really looking forward to eventually being able to like actually go out and like meet people and do signings and stuff like that. In the meantime, it feels kind of strange to like know that all these really cool things are happening, but to not be like seeing it play out in any tangible way.
It's like Schrodinger's success.
Yes.
Like it's there and it's not there. I really want that for you. You deserve to feel, you know, like I know what it meant to me and I'm like a damn adult. Like I know that so many readers have been so moved by your work here. And I'm really excited that you'll get to do that, you know, in theory, eventually. The other day, I was reading one of my favorite authors' Twitter feeds because, I mean, I can't believe I have this access to these great minds. And they were saying, you know, people always ask me how they can help out with my books, if they've already bought their copy or if they've got one from the library. And I say, you can rate and review me on Goodreads. Well, guess what, folks? You can rate and review us, too. It's really simple. If you don't know what to write in a review, just write, I liked it. Really, that's simple. Anything like that, hey, and go do that for your favorite authors. Like, help them out, please. But also do it for us. We are just two random-ass queer people trying to make this podcast happen, and we need help finding our audience. So help us out. That I thought was so cool, and so much of what, when Sarah and I think about Decoded Pride, you know, the anthology we publish annually where we uplift queer voices writing queer stories, queer and trans, is you said, you know, you wrote something that you're not allowed to write. Right, like people were like, hey, nobody wants Latinx books. Yeah. Nobody wants trans books. Certainly nobody wants gay trans books. And certainly no one wants all those things in a YA. And you were like, eh, oh well, still gonna write it. And I just, like, that's so magical. This to me is an example of what I think is so powerful and inspiring about us trans folks. Like, you can tell us no, and we'll be like, sure, that is how you feel. I have a different impression on this. And, you know, like, where did that determination come from, and how does it feel to know that you've written something that you're quote unquote not allowed to, and, you know, successful, at least in theory, again, since you can't feel it?
Well, what it makes me see is that there's just so much gaslighting within the publishing industry of being like, oh, no one wants this. This doesn't sell, but it doesn't sell because you won't sell it. It's like what I've learned from this experience.
Yes, yes.
But I think what's really funny about this process is that at the beginning, I wasn't like, well, I'm going to write this anyways. Like, I'm going to write this book because it's the book I want to write, and so be it. The process was a little bit more complicated than that, as most things are. So Cemetery Boys is actually my option book. The first book that I sold to Macmillan and to my editor was Lost in the Neverwoods, which is coming out this March. And Cemetery Boys was the book they were like, okay, we have gone through copy edits for Lost in the Neverwoods. What do you think about writing next? So I put together a list of pitches for my editor, Holly West, over at Macmillan and Five Will and Friends. And I believe I sent, it was either 5 or 6 stories. The first story, I had like 40K written. I had a full outline and a synopsis. The second one, there was like a fully outlined synopsis. And then like they kind of got more vague like as the email went on. And Cemetery Boys was the very last idea that I pitched. It was a paragraph long and most of the sentences ended in question marks because I was like, maybe he's trans and like maybe Latinx and also gay maybe? And what it was,
I love that. Just question mark. Let's find out.
I was like, I don't know. I mean, maybe. Like, what do you think? And really, what it was me asking permission to write about a boy who was like myself. I was asking permission to write about my marginalizations and my identity, and I was really afraid that it wasn't marketable. And that she was going to say, you know, no, I don't want that. So that's why I kind of kept it like low stakes of being like, oh, this is just really nonchalant and just like maybe it could be this book or whatever. So when I got a response from her very quickly afterwards, like this is how stressed and nervous I was about sending these pitches. I sent them on a Friday night and I'm on the West Coast and she's on the East Coast. So I was like, there's no way she's going to read this. I can just let it sit for the weekend and not have to stress out about it till Monday. But she ended up responding like that same night. It was probably like 9 o'clock her time or something. And she was like, yes, like Cemetery Boys. That sounds amazing. Let's do that one. And I was like, really? Like, I was absolutely shocked. And, you know, Holly being in the position of power that she is, she gave me that opportunity without having people in the publishing community who are excited and who want to uplift our voices or voices of marginalized folks, we can't break into it. So I'm really so grateful and thankful for Holly to giving me that opportunity. And then once she said, yes, you can do that, I was like, okay, well, then we are going like fully into it. Like, get ready. This is going to be super queer and trans.
So you had a written manuscript that has not been published. You wrote and published this in between that time.
So what was the process? I'm trying to think. So
fair enough.
So Lost in the Neverwoods went off to copy edits, and then they're like, what's the next book you want to write? I was like, I want to write Cemetery Boys. And they were like, okay, cool. And then like, I think it was after I sent them the first draft, they were like, you know, we think that this should be your debut. What do you think? And I was like, I would love for this to be my debut. So then it was this really complicated process. Lost in the Neverwoods has been sitting around waiting to be published for like 2 years at this point. And for Cemetery Boys, we decided to fast track it since we wanted it to be my debut. So I actually had to write the first draft in 6 weeks. And the process...
Holy crap!
I know. From the first draft to being sent off to copy edits was a year. We did everything in a year, which was very, very quickly.
Yeah, for people who don't know the publishing world, that is like... unreal. That's like,
yeah,
light speed. Wow.
Yeah. So first draft to not copy edits, but actually being published, because we just had this conversation a little while ago. It was exactly a year, within like a few days, I think. So yeah, it was totally a whirlwind situation. And then so Lost in the Neverwoods has just been kind of patiently waiting. And then so finally in March it gets to come out. And then I think the real kicker was that the original date that Cemetery Boys was supposed to be published, because I wrote it so quickly, was June 9th. And then because of the pandemic, it ended up getting bumped back to September 1st. So it was just like, oh, of course.
Yeah. I mean, what a wild year to debut.
Yeah.
What a wild year to debut so powerfully, right? I think you debuted as number 8 on the New York Times.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
It's pretty wild.
And are you working on your, I think I saw you saying on Twitter, you're working on your third book now. Is that correct?
Yeah. The first draft of my third book is due on March 1st. So I'm in the throes of writing that right now, which is really exciting and super fun. I'm having a good time with it. But, you know, writing in a pandemic is also difficult. I also wrote a rom-com, an entire rom-com during the pandemic, which... I want to edit myself a bit more before I actually send it off to my editor, because it's 140,000 words, which is way too long for a young adult rom-com. I was like, I don't know how this happened. So I need to edit that a bit.
So relatable. So relatable. You know, I want to come back a little bit to Cemetery Boys, because there's two aspects of representation. Well, there's many, many, many that I think are particularly cool. One, you know, a Latinx trans and gay character. Mm-hmm. And I know that's part of your experience and part of why you brought that to the page. And I also want to hear about, you know, a Latinx gay character with ADHD.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty fucking cool that Julian is allowed to show up on the page as a person with ADHD. My partner has ADHD, and I know that ADHD can create a lot of challenges for people. Actually, you know, it's society that creates the challenges.
Oh, yeah.
People with ADHD are fantastic. If I need an idea for a story, I just ask my partner. You know, and I'm like, here's 55 ideas. Okay, I can't use most of these, but this one's gold. But, you know, I think people really have responded to that. I think that having gayness be like, and Latinxness be like the common denominator, and then to also bring in transness and ADHD is really cool. And I'm curious, do you get any pushback where people like, they have too much going on? Were people supportive? And why did that matter to you? Why did all these layers matter? That they, not that they exist, but that they show up recognizably on the page?
Yeah. So I didn't get any pushback. And I think it's because the truth is that folks are layered people. Like, there's not just one part about us or our identity, right? We have multiple things going on. And so I think it really just gave him, or, you know, both of them, a realness to have these like multiple identities and these multiple marginalizations. And for Julian, it was so, so important to me. What I really wanted to do with him was subvert the bad boy trope. Because in fantasy, so first of all, in fantasy, I feel like your love interest is going to look and act a certain way. Like, how many fantasy books out there have like the dark and brooding love interest with like the blue eyes and black hair? And so I was like, okay, well, here's Julian Diaz, who has ADHD. He's Latinx. He hates school, and he's really goofy, and he's loud, and he's obnoxious too, because I really wanted to have a boy and a love interest who acted like a 16-year-old boy. That was really important for me. And I also wanted to unpack what we as society, especially in a school setting, determine what a bad boy looks like. And so when Yads is first like knows about Jules or asks Maritza's friends about him, they're like, oh, you know, he's no good. He's up to trouble. I heard that he's in a gang, you know, blah, 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 all these other terrible generalizations, where the truth is that he just has a really close, tight-knit, bound family. And the bad boy part of him is just that he has ADHD and his brain isn't built for a school structure that he's been forced into. And that's incredibly true for a lot of teenage boys, especially teenage boys of color, especially black boys. I mean, Jules isn't black, but that's a very real experience, is that they get labeled as bad boys just because they don't fit into how society wants them to function, especially within a school setting. It's not that he's a bad boy or gets into trouble. It's that he can't sit still, and that he doesn't learn by sitting in one place and having someone talk at him for, you know, 45 minutes at a time. So it was really important to me to unpack that and to kind of really directly address readers' assumptions and prejudices when they think about what a bad boy looks like. When it came to Julian, I really wanted to, yeah, kind of make people look at those ugly assumptions about themselves and then have to like deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of what makes the work so powerful is how true it rings and how it makes us question what we think we know. You know, like I don't have the evidence front of mind, but I remember thinking like, wow, Julian couldn't have helped Yad save the day if he didn't have ADHD. There's like a moment where he gets distracted at the end. I can't remember what it was, but I remember thinking like, wow, like how cool to treat ADHD not as a problem that someone's bringing to the table, but also as a source of value and of strength. And that feels so good to read something like that and just be like, oh, yes, we can love people for who they are. What?
I liked that you had a vegan character. I am vegan. And I was thinking about it because there's so few representations of a vegan character who's just like, this is just my belief system and isn't terrible. I like, you know, there's always all of these stereotypes around vegans and stuff like that. I mean, that's part of what stands out so much about Cemetery Boys, right? There's just a realness to like all of the characters. It does feel like you drew a lot from the people in your life. So
yeah, and I think what's really fun about like Maritza is like how she sticks by her morals, and she's a lot like Yads in that she knows exactly who she is and is going to stand by that. So, you know, when in her Bruhex community, they're like, well, in order to be a practicing Bruja, you have to use blood. She's like, oh, yeah, well, then I'm not going to use that magic. I'm just not going to be a healer then, because I don't want to use animal blood. And like another like funny part that I really wanted to incorporate is that veganism within the Latinx community, especially when you're trying to explain it to parents or grandparents, and they don't understand. They're like, what? You don't want meat? And then like, they'll like be like, here's some food. And you're like, that's chicken. And they're like, yeah, it's not meat. Like, if it's not like a cute animal, like, I don't understand what the problem is.
Right, exactly. Or if it's not like a part of, like, that's kind of something similar to my family was from like rural Missouri area. So like there's a lot of meat industry stuff there. And people would definitely be like, well, yeah, we made you some green beans. We cooked it in some lard. And I'm just like, okay, but if you could, so it's a vegetable, but you put it in animal fat. So like, I don't want to eat it. And like, you don't want to make people, it's like kind of a weird situation where it's like, I never want to shame people for what they eat. I don't care. Yeah. It's not about that. I'm just about what I do. And so I appreciated having like that kind of reflection a little bit, because it was just like,
yeah, you never see a vegan character who's just like, these are my beliefs.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the stereotypes exist for a reason and everything, but there's always that stereotype of the vegan who's just like, oh my God, are you going to eat meat? Like, people shouldn't eat meat and like all of that. So yeah, I just appreciated it. I thought it was a fun character.
Yeah, I love her. She's definitely one of my favorites. And I also think what's kind of funny about the adults, like all of the adults in Cemetery Boys, it's like they're trying really hard, but they just don't understand.
They don't get it.
What really resonated was also the idea that like young people are really feeling these pressures. Like truly, I think this book couldn't be an adult novel. It really is, you know, deeply entrenched in, you know, youth experiences. Oh God, I sound like I'm 90. The youth these days with their ADHD and their veganism, which obviously exists in any age. My point is, I think it's really powerful to have this truly young narrative, looking at young people not as potential adults and potential humans, which I think we do in our society, in particular in the US, but looking at them as like, no, they're people who are disenfranchised. They have less power than adults, you know, and then you add all these multiple marginalizations from there.
Yeah.
I just thought there was something really wonderful about the way that their youth, even when adults were like, you're too young, you don't get it. They were like, no, I do get it. What do you mean? You know, and that was such a, it felt like the community was able to support that tension. And I do think that's how we move forward, you know, within queer communities and trans communities in particular, but really in any communities, we have to be able to hold these tensions that are generational, that are what have you. But I love that the Bruhex community doesn't like fall apart. You know, they actually get stronger for the fact that Yods is there and protecting them and helping them, you know, like, wow, what a great way to like take something that could be divisive and is divisive in various points throughout the book, whether that be veganism or that be, you know, transness or that be queerness or that be having ADHD. And those things all become part of what makes everyone better. And I loved that tension because there's this point where Yods really feels like the world is on his shoulders. And it is to some degree. And he's like, I have to be the one that saves them. I have to be it. And what happens, right, is like people rally around him and help him and are like, you're not alone. We're here to be with you. And they, you know, give him that power of support, of loving understanding, things that we know trans youth need to be healthy and happy. Yeah. And it's like, yes, thank you. And then you had really cool brujeria, which like we haven't, we barely talked about. And I'd love to know how, you know, you put together the sort of, it's syncretic in some ways, the brujeria, and it's deeply Latinx, obviously. And I'm just curious, like, how did you build that magical system? And what do you think is like the most important aspect of it?
Oh gosh. I really feel like when I was like making this magic system for the book, I really cheated, honestly, because like what I got to do is like I got to pull from my lived experiences, especially when it comes to Dia de Muertos and the magic around that event, is that I just took our real life practices and beliefs and then I just gave them a very tangible output. And what I mean by that is like, for example, the marigolds and how we believe during Day of the Dead that their smell and their brightness is what leads our loved ones back from the afterlife. And so all I did was I took that and I put it in Cemetery Boys and I made it that they literally guide our loved ones back from the dead. And then, you know, everyone shows up and we have the party in the cemetery. So yeah, I really felt like I was cheating. But I think the most important part about the magic system is the deep familial ties and connections to our ancestors, which again, lived experience that's very true to our culture in general. And so I really wanted that to be a very intrinsic and important part of how the magic played out.
Yeah, I feel like the reason I read fantasy is because I like magical systems. Yeah. I'm just like, ooh, like I never studied chemistry, but I imagine it's like being interested in chemistry. Please forgive me, scientists who are listening. I know that's a ridiculous comparison, but I'm sticking with it. Yeah, and I loved the way that I'm trying not to spoil. That's why I'm like pausing.
Yeah,
like,
it's hard.
Here's what I'll say. I love that when the Bruhex community, when his family, and when even Yadz doubts himself, the magical forces do not.
Yes.
They know that Yadz must be there. The way that's revealed at the end and how it, oh, I'm going to cry talking about it. It's the hug that every trans kid deserves. It's the affirmation that every gay kid deserves, that every Latinx child deserves, that everyone who is marginalized in this weird society we live in deserves to be told, like, not only are you on mission, but you're on mission in a capital M sense, you know, like, yeah, you belong here using your brujería. And I think about that a lot. I think about how the magic forces show up and embrace and affirm Yadz. And it actually just makes me love myself a little better. Like, I'm like a little nicer to myself about, like, you know, what it means to be in this world and trying to do good and trying to find ways to fit in, but also finding ways to affirm myself without fitting in. And I don't know, it's just really incredible. I wonder how, like, what impact did it have on you to write something so damn affirming for trans people in a world where that's not what we have everywhere? And how did it impact your sense of self and did it?
Yeah, I think for me, that was a really, really important part of writing this book in general. Even at the very beginning, in the first chapter, the magic is gender affirming. And even though Yadz has been brought up in this community of Bruhex where it's very gendered, how it's set up, it's because that's how they've been practicing or even misusing it, I would say. And then when he goes and does his own rites of passage ceremony because his community won't do it for him, the magic knows and understands who Yadz is, that he's a boy, that he should be practicing Brujo magic, that he has these capabilities that the other men in the community have. And for me, that was really important because it's the same thing like in our lives and any kind of trans kids' lives. It's that society doesn't get to decide who you are. You know who you are. And because of that, the magic knows who you are. Magic doesn't care about what society has to say or what your family says or what kids at school say. It doesn't matter because it knows you on the most basic, most intimate, most personal level possible. So that was a really important thing for me to first establish at the very beginning of the story and then to really drive home towards the end of it. And that was a really, you know, a personal thing for me as well, because I think a lot of the time, trans folks, we feel like we have to prove ourselves to everyone else around us. And I really wanted to carve out that space and be like, you don't have to prove it to anybody, including yourself. You can just be who you are. And that's enough. That's the truth. That's who you are. It doesn't matter what society thinks. They don't get to decide who you are. You do.
Well, I think I have to go lay on the floor and cry for 3 hours. I'm very emotional about that message. And I'm like also like, you know, flashing back to reading Cemetery Boys in one marathon sitting. I was just like, I'm going to read a chapter. And then I was like, oops, read a book. It's 1 a.m. I need to go to bed now. I feel that in my soul. And as much as this is a YA book, and I think that's an imperative part, again, as I've said about the book, I think it's a message that all trans people need. Mm. I think there are very few people who are affirmed in their transness by their family and their immediate community if their community is not trans, if mm-hmm. their family is not trans. And I think that the idea that even when you doubt yourself, you're who you need to be, it's so gentle. It's so accepting that you are going to doubt yourself. Like, it's okay. Yeah. Like, I think as I found my non-binary-ness, I kind of like made a flag of it and like stuck it in myself because I was like, I just don't want anyone to like convince me this isn't the truth. Because there is a lot of, especially I think for non-binary people, but for trans folks in general, and I think lots of queer folks, there's a lot of like cajoling and a lot of like, are you sure? Like, what does non-binary really mean? And I'm like, I'm not a fucking professor. I don't know. I just, there was so much went under the term woman that didn't feel like home. Mm. And so much of it felt like a performance of what other people wanted from me.
Totally.
And that's not to say that I don't perform still non-binary-ness at different times, but I don't think we know what that means. So it's like, good luck, folks. You tell me, what do you think's my non-binary thing? I think it's all of me, but you know, whatever. Like, what stereotype do I fulfill? And there's just so much grace in saying, of course you're going to doubt yourself. Of course you're going to question. Of course you're going to feel like the world doesn't want you to find yourself, because it doesn't. But we do, right? Like trans adults, we want trans youth to find themselves. Yeah. I'm also looking at people my age going, sound pretty trans to me, friend. Like, I'm excited for your journey. Good luck. You know, like, I can't wait to see what happens. But we can't create enough space for that, I think, at this point, especially in literature, especially in YA literature, for just to say, welcome to the table. You don't have to know what it means that you're trans. You don't have to know what it means that you're non-binary. You don't have to believe yourself at every second of every day, because these are made up categories. And we get to decide which ones help, which ones harm, and how we want to use them. Totally. And that is a lot of power to give back to trans people.
Yeah, I totally agree.
That was my mini rant at the end. It happens most of the time when I get to talk to an author. I'm like, can I tell you what you're doing that's perfect? Because that's what I'd like to do now. Are you open to that? Sarah, did you have any other questions?
I sure do have one last one. And I was just wondering, with Cemetery Boys, was there any lessons that you kind of learned about writing while you were going through that you're going to take forward to your next project?
Oh, Sarah. I have so many mental breakdowns. What she does. Every time I turned in a draft, I was like, you know what? I don't think this book is any good. I remember I had turned in the first draft, which again, I wrote in 6 weeks, to my editor. And then I went to Seattle to attend a seminar by Maggie Stiefvater, who is one of my favorite authors.
Oh, yeah. Yes. She's legit.
It was really cool and it was wonderful. And the thing she said, I was like, it blew my mind, but it also made me be like, oh no, I haven't done any of this in Cemetery Boys. And I was like, oh no. And so what happened was when I got back to my Airbnb with my friend, bless her for dealing with me as I spiraled, I think we got home because we like went to dinner afterwards. And I think we got home at like 9 or 10 home by, I mean, the Airbnb. And I sent a frantic email to my agent. And I said, my agent is Jennifer Marsh-Soloway. And I was like, Jennifer, I just went to some Max Stiefvater's seminar and she was talking about all these things and emotional truths, and I was like, I don't have any of that in Cemetery Boys. I'm so worried. Should I email Holly? Should I take the draft back? And I was just like losing it. And like, bless her, she texted me that night and she was like, Aiden, I just want to remind you that you wrote this book in 6 weeks. It's not gonna have emotional arcs and like all these deep meanings yet because you wrote it in 6 weeks. Like, that's what happens in revisions. Like, you were just getting this, so we had a vague idea of what the plot's going to look like. She was like, I think you need to take a breather, give yourself some grace, and trust the process that things are going to get worked out. Her favorite thing to say to me, which she says very often, is, Aiden, you're worried, but you're well. And and I'm always worried, and it turns out I'm usually always well. So it was, yeah, self-doubt is like the name of the game. I don't know if you can be a proper author with like a bunch of self-confidence and being like, ah, yes, I just wrote a perfect draft, and I'm sure all the feedback I get will just be my editor congratulating me on how brilliant I am. If there's writers out there that exist, I don't know if they're very good writers, because I think
I was going to say, I can think of a list. They are all cishet white men and I don't like their books.
I am 0% surprised. So I think that's just kind of part of the process. And I, as terrible and awful as it is, I think it's also really good because it forces you and pushes you to do better. And so I think, even though I hate it and even though it's really awful to go through and stressful, it makes me a better writer. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I'm an editor as well as a writer. And so much of what I try to, you know, share with other writers is like, writing is rewriting. Yes, I know it's like blah, blah, blah. We all know that. But do we? Like, truly, your first draft is probably going to be some bullshit. There will be exceptions. Some things may come out beautifully. You may be like, this chapter is heaven on earth. You know what? I'm so happy for you. You may also find that when you're done with the book, that chapter is garbage. It's okay. Writing is like part science, but mostly magic, you know? Yeah. And I think that's a hard thing to instill in people is the faith that like, it is the process that makes books wonderful.
Absolutely.
You know, and it makes them something that I'm not religious, but to me, like books are my faith, you know, like stories and how we connect and how we make meaning. Those are the things that I draw inspiration from.
Totally.
Okay. So we know you have other projects coming. Can you tell us anything about them? You know, you've got Lost in Neverwoods.
Yeah.
Coming out in March. Holy crap. And then you've got like this third secret work in progress that's due March 1st. Like, what can you tell us?
Yeah. So Lost in Neverwoods is really, I'm so excited for it to finally be out in the world. And it's a very dark contemporary reimagining of Peter Pan. It takes place after the original story. And it's about kind of what happens to Wendy after she and her brothers go missing. But 6 months later, she's the only one who comes back and her brothers haven't come back yet. And so she's just turned 18 and kids in her small town start going missing in the woods. And Peter shows up claiming that he knows what happens and how to get her brothers back. And so it kind of turns into this really creepy, like very atmospheric fantasy. And it's really fun. And I'm really excited for that to be out in the world. And then, I have a duology coming out that's Demigods. So it's kind of, I've said Percy Jackson meets the Hunger Games. And that one's been really fun to draft so far. And that's going to be a duology.
I'm in. That sounds great.
Very excited.
Will there be anything in the future of Cemetery Boys? Or do you think that story is complete?
I think that there is so much in that world that I would like to explore. I would be really surprised if something else wasn't created, whether it's like a spinoff or a sequel or even like a graphic novel.
I was going to say a comic book. Oh my God. Yes.
I would love to have a graphic novel. That would be like incredible. So
I'm already thinking of the creative team. I'm very excited. This would be incredible.
So I would be shocked if something else didn't come about. The only thing is that Cemetery Boys was so important and I feel like so happy with it that the story that I come up with needs to be really good. I'm not going to just write something to have more content. If I'm going to create another piece to this story, I want it to be really, really good.
So cool. So cool. Yeah, I am. I'm very excited for what the future holds for you, Aiden. I am confident that you're going to be telling us really good stories for many, many years to come. And I will be there reading them because I like them very much. Thank you. I might be, you know, up until 1 a.m. every time you have a book come out. Let's see. It's a new journey for me. Not really. I was 9 in my bed reading, you know, Tolkien, being like, wow. So thank you so much for joining us today. If people want to find you, they can find you on social media at what again?
Aiden Schmaden.
So A-I-D-E-N
and then S-C-H-M-A-I-D-E-N.
We will also tag Aiden when we share this interview and we'll have it in the show notes. So if you're like, I don't know how to spell Schmaden, that's okay. I think it's really funny, but we will have it in our show notes. So go to our website, bitchesoncomics.com, and we'll get you hooked up with that. And then you also have a website. Is that correct?
Yeah, Aiden-Thomas. A lot easier.
And you have like some really cool stuff about your new book on there, right?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of content on there for my upcoming projects. And also for Cemetery Boys, every piece of art that my cover artist, Mars Lauterbaugh, has created for Cemetery Boys is on the website. So you can go there and look at all of them. It's really cool.
Cry your eyes out.
Yeah.
Soothe yourself with the love of Yadriel and Julian. Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much for taking time for us. We really enjoyed your book. We really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We're Bitches on Comics, and we hope that you're hanging in there.
Bye.
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 We are a podcast that is all about making comic books more accessible to LGBTQ folks and women. So if you have a question about anything related to comics, comic adaptations, pop culture in general, conventions, cosplay, you name it, that's what we're here for. You can send us your questions at bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. Unfortunately, Gmail does not like the word bitch. They're pretty judgy about it. So we can't have it spelled out. It is bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. And do you remember, there's no I in bitch.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.